This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. The Kansas City Star moderated a forum last Monday night, May 20th, with mayoral candidates Jolie Justice and Quentin Lucas. Here's an excerpt from that forum that would be of most interest to Eco Radio KC listeners.
My name is Gretchen Waddell Barwick. I represent the Sierra Club and the Heartland Conservation Alliance. And our first question is, in 2018, the City Council adopted Resolution 18475 to transition Kansas City to 100% renewable energy community-wide. The city is on track to meet this goal, but to go community-wide, we will need large-scale energy efficiency and a transition to clean renewable energy like wind and solar. As mayor, what concrete steps will you take to help our larger community meet this goal? And how will you prioritize disproportionately impacted communities like low-income and fixed-income families in a just transition to renewable energy?
That is a great question, and we also, just so you can follow up, in addition to the 2018 resolution, we had a 2019 ordinance that said we are putting this into effect by 2020, and that's a really big deal because we have seen Kansas City be a leader in issues of how we're going to combat climate change, but guess what? We are also on a top 10 list of cities that are going to be least resilient when it comes to combating climate change and how we are going to be affected by it, and we're already seeing it. We're seeing it in our flooding, we're seeing it in our tougher winters and our tougher summers, and it is impacting the entire city, but it impacts our poorest communities the most, without question. And so one of the things that we have to do is, number one, when we are talking about economic development incentive reform, it has to include a component of making sure that we are including these requirements in with our development requirements. It is something that we can do that other cities have done. We can start with very basic things like saying you must retain your own stormwater on your property if you're going to be getting incentives from the city to build. These are small things we can do, but in order to make sure that we're scaling this up and having it something that affects the entire community, we need to make sure that we have incentives, true incentives, for individuals who want to make changes at home. We need to make sure that we are giving credits for individuals that are buying more energy efficient appliances. And we need to make sure, as we start to make the transition from fossil fuels to renewable, that we don't lose this opportunity to work with Kansas City Power and Light and Spire, and we've already started these conversations, to turn these new things into green and blue collar jobs. I want to start at the middle school and the high school level to make sure that we have trained the workforce to be a part of that complete change of how we're doing things here in Kansas City. And then, of course, we don't stop there. We have to make sure we're continuing to come up with public transportation options and getting people out of their cars so that we can continue to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels.
You know, it's my view that, and I agree with many of the points, but when we talk about sustainability, more than us having more conversations and task forces, which are things that we do a lot of at City Hall, we need to transition to action, and action that stems some of our gross energy inefficiency. For example, and I'll get a little boring right here, but in our planning, how we lay out and plot our city, we fundamentally support sprawl. In our planning and zoning codes, we require these lengthy setbacks. We're building new housing developments that are further away from the street than they were 60 years ago or 70 years ago, requiring us to actually use fuel to get around a lot more. So what I would like to see us do is, as we're approving new developments and new communities, making walkability a requirement within them, removing parking requirements, which is one of those aforementioned housing ordinances that I passed, actually, and that we were able to actually get done successfully. I want us to make sure that when Public Works is buying new, extensive fleets of vehicles, we're actually looking for renewable resources being used as fuel. Those are certain things that we can actually do to impact immediately. And those are things that Kansas City, Missouri needs to do more often.
Kansas City, Missouri mayoral candidates Quentin Lucas and Jolie Justice responding to the Sierra Club's Gretchen Waddell Barrick's question at last Monday's mayoral forum held at Rockhurst University and moderated by the Kansas City Star. On Thursday, May 23rd, the Kansas City, Missouri City Council paid tribute to outgoing Chief Environmental Officer Dennis Murphy. After some kind words from many of the City Council, Mr. Murphy addressed the group.
Thanks to all of you. I appreciate the very kind remarks you've made about my time here in Kansas City. I would note that on many occasions, in talking to my colleagues, my counterparts from around the country, I've indicated that while we're really proud of the things that we've been able to achieve in Kansas City over the past decade plus, it's been in large part because we've had mayor, a city council, and a city manager that understand the importance of what we've been trying to do. And so in that regard, I've been among the most fortunate of chief environmental officers, sustainability directors, whatever titles that various cities use. I've also been very fortunate to have an outstanding staff. The Office of Environmental Quality is a very small group. There's only 9 people in the office, but the reach of the Office of Environmental Quality has been incredible. And I would have to say that I have been doing environmental work for 43 years, 13 of them here in Kansas City. This is the best job I've had. It's the reason I've been here longer than any other job I've had. But I've also had the best staff to work with here in Kansas City. And as Councilwoman Shields noted, I told her earlier that I was really fortunate to come to Kansas City 13 years ago when this community was really ready to have a different kind of conversation about the direction that we want to go in the future. And so I count my blessings. I'm very grateful for having had the opportunity to be here and to be a part of what's happened in Kansas City over the past 13 years. And I have very high hopes and expectations that I'll hand the baton off to someone else that will take us even further. So thank you very much.
Again, that was Kansas City, Missouri's outgoing Chief Environmental Officer, Dennis Murphy, addressing the City Council. For Eco Radio KC and 90.1 FM, I'm Mike Murphy.
Thank you, Mike. Do you like food? I like food. We all like different things about food, and discussions around what's good eating have been and are always going to be the makings of good, heartfelt conversations. The making of our food and what goes into the growth of that food is what's really been eating me for the past 25 years or so, since I first ate a fresh Cherokee purple tomato at the farmer's market in 1994. Markets are one of the best places you can go to learn about good food. And I used to be a manager at farmers markets a few years back, and I found out that the only way to really know about the nature of your food isn't just going to the market, but you got to go to the source, the farm, and the farmer. They can show you the truth behind the food if you can witness the methods they use to produce it. Where do the nutrients come from? How is it watered? How are the weeds and bugs handled? Who is working the land, and how are they treated? These are the questions that matter as we want the best going into the foods that become part of us. On today's episode, we're going to hear from Jake, Jenna, Nora Lee, and Aster at Sacred Sun Farm. They show us around discussing all things that get the seeds to pop and fruit. And this is a recording from about 6 weeks ago or so. And as you listen, imagine if this were a farm powered by fossil fuels, covered with pesticides, doped up with fertilizers, and over-medicated with antibiotics, what would that be like? Could the children play around the farm so freely and help out with the work? Would they have the same chance to learn about nature and healthy ecosystems? In this first segment, we take a walk in the hoop house, squelch in the mud, hear the percolation of the compost tea, and get educated about eating wild foods and integrated pest management by preschooler Nora Lee.
Three pigs in one year and I really like having pets. Pigs around.
No, he likes to go see all the pretty dandelions.
You want some pigs?
And all the plantains you make.
I just want those things.
Do you want to?
Yeah. Yeah, show me the plants. Oh, you're good at unwrapping that gate. Where there's not as many plants is where you can walk.
You can't walk right here.
You don't want to walk on your food.
No, by all means. It's funny, we...
You could probably eat all that stuff.
Composted stuff in here and ended up getting a bunch of volunteer nettles, which is great. Because we are
trying to grow nettles on the
this year. Oh, fun. So if you like to, you can taste
lot of, like, a really wide diversity of herbs. And that's how she started making these herbal teas.
Okay.
So we're actually trying to grow herbs on a larger scale. Like an 80-foot-long bed of nettles that we can hopefully, we've got some friends that are midwives and doulas that are...
Stinging nettles?
Yeah.
It's a little muddy here.
Yeah. You want this to take home?
What is it?
The dandelion.
Yeah.
The bed's not springtime quite yet.
That.
Yeah, it's a ladybug. Ladybugs.
Careful on that plant. That's a prickly plant.
I like to keep the ladybugs on the lettuces because they don't eat greens.
Yeah.
So I like to keep them on. Come on.
It likes your hand. Well, it doesn't eat the lettuce. Why does it want to be on the lettuce?
Because it eats bugs, and bugs like broccoli. They like to eat aphids. Eat lettuce. So I keep it on the lettuce.
So ladybugs are good to have for you. Your lettuces. It doesn't want to stay there, though. Maybe there's not enough aphids today. Did you eat all the aphids already, ladybug?
There's some other ones, too.
The lettuce looks pretty healthy.
Hi.
Maybe the aphids aren't out yet. Hey, ladybug's hungry. She'll find some food.
You want to show us the green ones?
I think this stuff is just happier.
Yeah.
I think it's just bigger.
You want to go see a greenhouse?
So you can eat these?
Oh, yeah. They taste like broccoli. A little bit more bitter, but not by much.
Oh, wow. I didn't know you could do that. Just eat those shepherds. That's shepherd's purse, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Mud. You can pick as many as you want.
He's stepping in mud.
Take them back.
It's muddy out here, isn't it?
You can take as many as you want.
Okay. Yeah, you were offering it to me. Didn't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now I do.
Eat it for dinner.
Those lettuce babies look good.
Good.
That's really tasty.
What's that?
So do you have some live stuff in there?
No, this is actually just that extra barrel right now serving as a trash can.
So, this is just the compost tea all by itself.
Yeah.
It's not related to these cans.
Now it'd be nice to get into a bigger system. And we actually have like a tank on wheels. That
can I show you?
Can I show you?
Can I show you? Look at all the babies.
Yeah, but you're not.
You think those are carrots? They look like carrots, don't they? But they're not quite carrots.
Are they?
It's beautiful.
Yeah. They're fennel.
So we had this. So this was twice as long. This greenhouse was actually our hoop house that I had up at my parents' farm when we moved it down here when we started the place. But the county made us here again, so we moved it up here.
It's been
like, you know, the fans are going to kick on when they're supposed to. And it's really cool. This year we were able to like actually meet a couple of friends that wanted greenhouse space. And so we were able to like, rent them a little bit of space and we're kind of doing that cooperatively and figuring it out as we go.
So what kind of plants are growing in here right now?
It's all vegetables.
There's some herbs.
There's kohlrabi and some bok choy and over here we've got more choys and kale and stuff like that that are about to go out. This is a neat idea to just
onions, carrots.
Yeah, well, all of our onions.
Beets.
Yeah, this is the idea.
Dada,
that
it's almost like dirty in here, Dada. Dada.
And that way you can
it's almost dirty in here.
Better seed.
Dada, it's almost dirty in the mini greenhouse.
Yeah, yeah, we've got it opened up to max. They like the heat, though, so they're probably fine with it. Oh, yeah, they're happy.
You think she's a cute one?
You should try it. It's tasty.
Jess has elderberries going back there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She's taking our petals.
From here or from somewhere else?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah, we have some elderberries down in the road.
Yeah. And so are you going to spread them around to your place or other places?
Oh, probably ours.
Yeah?
Yeah, just trying to fill out the bed so we have a full 80 feet.
Cool.
You know, elderberries.
So what do you do with your elderberries?
We make syrup with them and sell it at market.
What kind of plant some rose bushes?
Yeah.
So how long have you been selling at market?
This is our third season at Brookside.
Yeah, so we've been selling at markets for four seasons. I guess we took a year off.
No, throughout the
this is our seed shaker So.
A little water.
More water.
I learned like...
I never grew up using a seed germination cabinet or knowing what to do there. And, oh, hey, this cornflower is like...
I know. It popped in like 3 days.
Do you want to pull it out?
Okay. So tell me about a seed germination cabinet.
Yeah, it just keeps like warmth and humidity. And so you get more consistent germination on all your seeds. Like trying to get everything to pop at the same time and trying to get it to pop faster. Just so that way you can get crops out to the bench and get in sunlight. And you know what I mean? Just...
And you've got lights in this. Does it have to have lights?
You don't have to. And there's a lot of people that do it like way differently. I've seen people that just stack flats on top of flats, so they're in the dark, but it's just like a hot, humid, damp, dark environment. But they're like so on it that they know they're like, okay, we put these in, and 36 hours later, we got to pull them because they will be sprouted. And so here, Jess has like skull cap going. This is a flat of like some saved peppers, these like tiny little Thai peppers that are like really adorable when you string them up.
And then this over here is...
So this is actually neat. This is a greenhouse that Jess had in high school.
Wow.
And we just
your family got you a greenhouse to... Or did you...
My mom had one in the backyard.
Oh, wow, that's
that
cool.
She put up for like things that she thought she'd actually do and then she didn't actually do, so...
So you did it.
So I did.
So what did you grow when you were in high school?
I had just a little garden in the backyard and did like potatoes and green beans and tomatoes and things like that. They're just playing in the water.
And so does this then take things that like more heat?
Yeah. It keeps things at a more consistent temperature, especially overnight when like the tomatoes don't want to go below 50. So we can keep all of this at 40 and keep that at 50 and save heating costs.
Greenhouse in the hoop house.
Yeah.
And it's got a little heater.
Yeah. With like a
space heater.
Uh-huh. It's been really handy. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. We just blow through a lot of gas pretty fast trying to keep one of these, you know.
Right.
The goal actually is that this fall, so uphill here,
up at the top of the hill, is we want to start digging into that bottom there and doing multiple sheltered greenhouses.
Yeah. So just use the Earth's heat rather than artificial.
Yeah, and hopefully then we can also get like passive 50 degree temps in the winter, and we'll be able to move some of our stuff in when we keep alive.
Thanks for listening to KKFI. Be sure to like and follow your community radio station on social media at KKFI 901 FM. And thanks for 30 years of support.
KKFI is the Kansas City area's independent, non-commercial community radio station. We seek to stimulate, educate, and entertain our audience to reflect the diversity of the local and world community and to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues, and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. Interested in volunteering? contact 816-994-7864 or go online at kkfi.org and click the volunteer tab. Thank you for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Just add water. It's a recipe for success on this current cast. Hennepin and Hopper Lakes in Illinois were once drained to make room for crops, but ecologist Gary Sullivan said keeping the land dry was a challenge.
It's kind of like a bathtub that just keeps filling.
So when the nonprofit Wetlands Initiative restored the land, they stopped pumping the water out.
Once water got on that landscape, aquatic plants just started germinating across these corn and soybean fields where they hadn't seen water in nearly 100 years. And it was absolutely astounding.
The restoration was so successful, those once sodden cornfields are now home to the Dixon Waterfowl Refuge. And visitors flock to the area for some of the best birdwatching in Illinois. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiswitz, and this is Climate Connections. When he was a child, Kansas resident Ken Lastman visited his ancestors' graves every Memorial Day.
I'm a fifth generation Douglas County. I was born and raised here, and so it was kind of a big deal to go out to the Oak Hill Cemetery. It was just this annual ritual.
The 64-year-old remembers that on those visits, he always saw the colorful blossoms of peonies, a traditional graveside planting.
I thought it was really cool that the past generations thought about our generations by planting those peonies so that there would be something blooming on Memorial Day.
But as the climate has warmed, Lastman's noticed that the peonies often bloom earlier than they used to.
By the time Memorial Day occurred, a lot of years it has passed the blooming time.
His observations are corroborated by research that shows many plants are now flowering earlier and earlier as the climate warms. Lastman is now looking for other flowers that are likely to bloom on Memorial Days in the future. He thinks it might be time to create a new tradition.
So I certainly want to give it a try, and maybe we'll have a range of plants so that we make sure that something is going to be blooming.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Back with more of our audio tour of a local sustainable farm, Sacred Sun Co-op. In this portion of the tour, we begin with a look at the bus turned tiny house and living quarters for farm help and a potential temporary home for what's called Woofers, which is a worldwide organic farmer organization. Where young people, or people really of all ages, but a lot of young people, travel and act as farmhands all over the world and learn about biological farming practices. And you can find out more just by Googling, I believe it's W-O-O-F-F, and woofing. It's a fun thing to do, maybe something to do for your summer. Also, listen for the sounds of shelling garbanzo beans in this next segment. And different small mills that are used at Sacred Sun to create the flowers that they provide for their customers.
This is real. Right
there
is one of
those
fence trailers. Four buses that are using right now.
Save us some.
Okay, everybody, bye. John lived in for a while. And they had it parked in another place down south of Lawrence, and they were like, you guys got to move it. So they brought it here. So we're going to have it as a space for woofers or interns or things like that to live.
Wow, it's like a little bungalow, airplane bungalow kind of. Yeah,
it's cool. There's like the downstairs area has like a little kitchenette and the bed and that kind of thing. And then there's like that loft area that's he built for his daughter.
That is so cool. Wow. Yeah.
It's pretty rough, but is a fun space for some, like, just a single person.
Yeah.
Something.
So have you had woofers?
Yeah, we've had some woofers. Not a crazy amount.
You're on the site right now.
Huh?
You're on the woofing site?
Yeah, we're on the woofing site. Do you need boots? Well, you took some off, and now you're stuck with them. Do you want me to just hold you?
No. So what's this?
Last year, or what's left of them. We just grew enough. We just harvested it by hand, and we threshed them by hand and cleaned them on the seed cleaner, but there was enough there for CSA. So it's like, you know, they just put in like 1 to 2 little garbanzos per pod, but they make a lot of pods. And so, I don't know. I think there's a lot of promise for it. I mean, everyone likes hummus, right? I say that, but that's not necessarily true. But
well, you can use it for lots of it.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, we had a bunch of splits, and so we included a recipe in our CSA for, it's called chana dal, like Indian food. Yeah, and I was just like, oh, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, falafel, I mean, all the things we love. So,
is there a faster way to do this than
by yeah, the combine, for sure. And I can show you it over there. The garbanzos grew, but they grew so small that we couldn't harvest them direct with the combine. So we ended up pulling the plants by hand and threshing, and it was just like a real labor of love. But lo and behold, they grew, I think, on a larger scale and, you know, better conditions.
You got these kids here. You know, they could...
Right? If you want any of those values. But then just some of the other gear, like... this is our little stone mill, which we just used to grind up masa last. But it's got, you know, 6-inch stones, and we found this and fixed it, and it's been our mill for years. But it's unfortunately broken in that, like, a bearing, a bushing, we've used it too much. And so it's out of alignment, and as you can see, there's, like, a gap here and not a gap there. Mm-hmm. And so it's out of, and so it creates...
These are supposed to grind the grain in between them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it creates unnecessary amount of friction, and then the thing...
So these are just, like, big stones, like you'd sharpen a knife with or something. So
yeah, I think it's actual granite. I think that, like, some of the best mills are made with, like, pink granite. I've seen advertised, but I've seen other people advertise, like, you know, our corn is milled with volcanic stones, which is really cool. But there's also, like, just synthetic stones or stones that are made out of, like, granite dust that have been bound together with some polymer. This is the seed cleaner. This thing is super cool, and I think this sounds awesome. So let me turn it on real quick.
Manufactured by A.T. Farrell and Company.
Yeah, so it's the
Saginaw,
the Clipper Company. And so the old seed cleaner on my parents' place, my dad's, is a 4-screen clipper. This is a 2-screen clipper. Was actually, this is what the clipper sales guy would have in the trunk of his car. And he would drive it to a farm, and it's meant to operate without electricity. You'd hook up a crank here, but he'd go and talk to the farm and be like, you can get this much foreign material out of your wheat if you bought a clipper. And he'd run it through there, and out would come that, and the little stuff would come out over here, and, you know, he'd sell big machines that way. So we got this, I got this at an estate sale back up in Brown County, and there's an electric motor hook to it. And we do, like, all of our cleaning with this. So I called up Clipper, because A.T. Farrell, because I was interested in more screens for it. And I told the guy what I was doing. He's like, what are you doing? What? Like, because it just takes forever, you know?
It's a little demo machine.
Yeah, he's like, that's a toy. Like, that's a kid's toy. So, you know, we've been on the lookout for, like, a bigger cleaner. But in the same respect, we are growing, you know, smaller plots and... For us, it actually is kind of the right tool for the job. It works out. We have all these screens we can change out. So, you know, the goal is you take the biggest stuff off, like wheat chaff off, or like, you know, straw, and then the stuff falls through, and then it lands on the bottom screen, and the bottom screen is set too small. So then this catches like little teeny tiny wheat and wheat middlings, they call it, you know, fall through. Those come off, and what you're left is with your appropriate, it says wheat, so it comes down here and it falls over the edge, and then there's a fan that blows air across it, and that helps to get rid of chaff or anything that might be the right size but not the right density, and then the cleaned product falls down in here.
But depending on what we're doing, sometimes I just need to clean, like, debris out of corn or, like, splits out of corn. And so I'll just take it off the top screen and catch it there. But it's like...
This E.T. Fertile. I mean, that's it. They're still producing things.
Yeah, and they still make cleaners out of wood. I mean, wood and steel, and it's like, yeah, they haven't changed a whole lot. It's really great. I mean, there's new cleaners, but it's like, all in all, the technology is it's just shaking stuff over a screen, you know? So, and then this is another cool machine. So when I first started milling back up at my parents' farm, I have a mill. It's actually over there, but it's like a hand crank mill. It took forever. So I was like, I'll never get up to a bicycle. So I did. And my design didn't work that well. This one works actually really well. And I like this. This is put together by a guy named Eric Farnsworth in Lawrence, but we got to hold on to it out here. And so when our main mill broke down, I started grinding wheat on this, wheat and corn. But it's just more. Takes more horsepower than I have.
Can I try?
Oh. Tell us about it. So I read a note to it. So much better. Really, it's like, I first mill was like a steel bird mill, and I created my first mill, so it's a much better design, and I feel like, this is actually doing a great job, and the whole thing is like really important. This takes longer, but it's nice and slow, and it doesn't heat up the grain, because if the grain gets hot, it like really breaks down the grain. Set this to grind and then run and do some stuff and come back and check this and do some other stuff and come back and check this. And so
we're saving up. We want to get
like
it to
a little kitchen mill kind of thing, right?
Maybe. Yeah. It's been first rigged to a bike and then rigged to a motor. So
a lot of people would have just skipped the whole bike setup, but actually this worked out kind of well in that it was like already had a gear reduction going on.
Yeah.
And so we took the motor off of our,
this is our old corn shelter where we put your corn through. Season from our neighbor Tim O'Brien, who lives just a few miles that way, and he's been raising it. And it's a dent corn, it's not a flint corn. So it's like, you know, the yellow corn that you see out in the fields, except it's open pollinated, not Roundup Ready or any of that baloney. But anyway, it mills great, it has great like milling and baking properties, and we take it and grind it for wheat grits and wheat flour and corn, or sorry. corn grits and corn flour and corn meal, and it just bakes, it cooks really fast, unlike flint corn that takes a really long time. Mm-hmm. And then we do the niche demolition on it too, and turn it into our masa. So
this is what you've been selling at the market, the masa.
Yeah. And this cool machine, you know, you just put the whole cobs in, the whole ears in,
really?
And it strips it all off and spits it out the bottom, and it even shoots the ear out the back. So,
and it was $125.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, like all of our gear is like, we have to go with like super cheap gear because, you know, we can't spend a lot of money and stuff.
And also, it's great that people are selling it and you're able to, you know, that it's still in use. I mean, this thing is how old, do you think?
Oh, man. This thing is probably from like the 30s. Yeah. But it's like, a lot of our gear that we get, like our corn planter is like an old cast iron John Deere corn planter, just a 2-row. It was actually my grandpa's, and it's just like, a lot of the stuff that we use is, you know, antique, definitely by today's standards. But, you know, it's too small or it's antiquated, so no one wants it. And so we end up saving it basically from the scrap metal guys that, you know, save us. And that's great. Hey, Nora.
When he was up there for about 3 years, and that was 5 years ago.
Yeah, I've been certified there since 2013.
And George is a corn grower.
Yeah, just like, you know, like on a traditional Kansas farm. So corn and wheat, soybeans, and milo, cattle, up in Brown County, a little town called Powhatan. It's like population 50. So it's about an hour from here. And then, yeah, growing up on the farm, I was, of course, urged to not be a farmer and to go do something else. So went to school to become an architect and then got back into farming, you know. But, yeah, I helped my parents. I moved back home to their place in 2010. And, you know, Mom and Dad were receptive. They were kind of retiring and wanted to do more with less acreage. Wanted to sell some land, actually. And so they did. And, you know, we started the transition thing. And had a bunch of successes all along the way. Like, it's crazy. Like, we grew rye. That's a cover crop. And the NRCS, it's Natural Resource Conservation Service. So, like, every county or every region has, like, NRCS officers. But they do things. There's actually a really great program called EQIP that will help you in your transition to organic farming. And part of that is they'll pay for cover cropping. They'll pay you for taking land out of production. Like, because, you know, you could have, because otherwise it would have been into, like, GMO corn and soy or something. So they really helped us, and...
Because you have to leave it for a while.
Yeah, three-year transition period. So, you know, we put in alfalfa, and we sold a ton of alfalfa. I, like, put up so many small square bales of alfalfa, it's ridiculous, you know? And we grew rye, and sold it to a local mill because everybody wants rye right now for a cover crop. Even like the conventional guys, you know, they even get, you know, guys flying on rye. They have an airplane that distributes the rye and, yeah, applies it to a standing field of corn. So that way when they harvest the corn, the rye is left behind and grows up and, you know, does good things for the soil and the biology of the soil, the microbes.
Saves them some fertilizer.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, definitely the rye, like,
keeps
yeah.
the ground healthy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually, I think that I'm now beginning to learn more about how cover crops actually help. Like, and it's not just about keeping the soil in place, and it's not just about tying up excess fertility. It's also about keeping the microbial activity of the soil awake and active and reproducing. And so that's been kind of like a neat revelation in just the past few months. So, yeah.
And you got that. The knowledge then to go and do this at your dad's place and this place from where? Where did you learn how to?
Oh, yeah. So I went and worked at the Kansas City Center for Urban Agriculture in 2008. Yeah, 2008. And that's when, like, Catherine Kelly and Daniel Dermitzel were running the place, and they taught me tons about vegetables. And so when I moved back to my family farm, I grew vegetables there and, you know, was helping start some farmers markets in Brown County, but also had wondered, you know, what to do with all of this land, and so organic grains. And luckily there's a handful of organic growers up there in Brown County already. A friend from when I was younger named Jack Geiger and Jake Geiger, the Geiger family, have been growing organic since the 80s. And other organic farmers in the area, like Ed Resnichak, and a bunch of folks. Just there's more resources than I thought, and so actually it's a really great network of farmers, and we all actually use the same organic certifier called OCIA, and so we you know, talk shop and have a yearly meeting, and, you know, if I'm out of something, I can call neighbors and they let me know if they have it or not. Yeah, it's really great.
And so these people were growing a variety of things, including grains.
Somewhat. None of them were really doing, like, farmers market sales. Everyone was pretty much doing, like, you know, grains, livestock, hay, you know.
Okay. So the grains for the animals, mostly?
Yeah. Or just for sale, yeah. You know, just in general. But they just have so much knowledge, you know, that it was really, yeah, invaluable. And it's nice to not feel like the only person doing something, you know? Yeah. Like, you kind of need a community of growers to, like, I don't know, just not feel like you're out there all alone.
So, is there anybody else growing grains for market?
Yeah, I think there are. In fact, some people, like in Lawrence, I know Moon on the Meadows is growing turkey red wheat and was milling it and had that for sale, and that was really cool. Some other friends at Wakarusa Valley were growing some different corns and were doing a masa, but they were making like a wet masa. So it was just, you know, you got to get it fresh and you got to use it right then kind of thing. By going through and doing a dry masa harina, it's just kind of easier for us. And
so, okay, so that next extremalization, during that, it gets wet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you guys made hominy or any of that before?
No, I haven't. Can you explain extremalization?
Yeah, niche demolization, or how would they say it? So we take our red corn and we slow simmer it in a pot of lime water. And then, after, an hour or so, we, like, find when it's tender, and then we take it off and it sits for 8 hours. And then the next morning we rinse it, and then we put it in the food dehydrator. And then once it's dehydrated, we can grind it in our mill, and that makes a masa flour, masa harina. And then we can take that and add it back to water and make corn tortillas. It'll actually, like, bind together and hold together. Regular corn flour won't do that. So, yeah.
And so that's what most corn tortillas are made with, and hominy is made from that process.
Yeah. So that's how we do it, at least.
And then also masa, I guess, if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, I guess if you just ate it wet, it would just be, that's how you make hominy. But we don't typically do that as much, so, yeah.
And so, I'm just curious, like, you've got cornmeal and masa, so what's the, like, why? What is the difference in terms of, like, usage-wise?
Yeah, so, like, you can't make a tortilla.
I guess it just, that's just not sticky, it doesn't create that.
Yeah, it actually, like, I think it actually converts the corn to where there's more, binding molecules or something there. There's a reason why the Aztecs invented it, or Mesoamericans. But yeah, so they can do that. And then we grind just the corn into corn flour or corn meal or corn grits for other just recipes and stuff. Like, I like to bread with it. I like to, you know, almost do like a, well, like chicken, you know. Mm-hmm. I like to bread. Is there a chicken coop? And it's really neat. We raised turkeys last year, too. That was fun. We try a variety of different things every year, but I know we try to limit it to, like, 10 or so experiments, like major experiments, you know?
10.
Yeah. So, this is our coop, and these are all our girls. We got about 100 chickens, 100 layers right now. We've raised some meat birds, and honestly, I've had really good luck with them. I know people talk about the Cornish cross, you know, the white broad-breasted meat bird is like, oh, there's like the Franken chickens, and they're so weird, and they're not. They're like,
no.
Really, have you guys ever raised any? They're pretty. They're like really sweet, actually. And if anything, maybe they're a little, I don't know, maybe they're dumb, or maybe they're just like not, don't have as much instinct in them or whatever, but they waddle around and they're cute, and they, you know, they just want to come up to you because they know you got food. Like, I don't hold that against them, so... So yeah, but the turkeys were really cool too. The turkeys were awesome, and they were just an industry bird, but we raised them with organic feed that we grow, and like they call to each other. You can really hear them like talking, like their bird talk is really neat. So yeah.
Right there.
Yeah, we tried it on a small scale, so we want to scale it up this year. But also the big thing that we're doing with all of our birds is we're just trying to get all of them out on pasture. So this chicken coop has like 4 different paddocks around it. And we in the past years, just like trying different strategies to keep it cover crops. They've always got like green stuff to root through, but it's like in this past year, the winter's been so long, they have just destroyed all the grass.
Yeah.
And they're going to keep doing that. And, you know, I think it could be good to use this for maybe raising up chicks, but we want to get all of our birds out on pasture. So that kind of torn up camper trailer over there that we're sitting next to, that's the mobile. So we'll have that. And we can fit 100 birds in there.
Really?
Down and then the electronet around, because they'll have plenty of grazing area. They'll just go in there at night for protection.
Do you have roosters?
Huh? Yeah, just a couple. I have so many. We had like 3 or 10 at one point, and I had to go through and pull them. But so it's got this cut bar here.
This is a humongous machine.
It is big. Cuts it. The walls come to this belt. You know, this, like, paddles it on there. The belt goes up and delivers it up into there. There it's got, like, a rotating cylinder that threshes the grain for you. And then all that means is the back. And on the back, there's those screens, just like the screen cleaner, but way bigger. And so they're shaking side to side, and it shakes it through and everything. And then, so, like, a bit of a winnowing with the straw gets into the tank right there, and then you can shoot it out of that auger out into a vessel. This is, like, the perfect combine for us because we can harvest, like, 1 acre of something. We got it for $50. We got over $50, but I had to, like, go all the way to, like, Lacine, Missouri, and it's wider than you can actually have going down the road, and you can't pull it back fast, so we had to, like, get bridge plank and with winches and my dad's help pull it up onto a car trailer and get it home that way. But yeah, it's, like, it's really cool. I grew up always just seeing combines that you drove, like big John Deere self-propelled combine, but this is
air conditioning.
Yeah.
So it's it, and then it puts it, and then it slides down, and then it puts it right there.
Yeah.
And then what it would do would, this would spin, and it would flip it up there.
See it making that chain over there? See how it's doing that? See how it's moving that chain?
How?
Because it's connected. It's all connected. This belt, see? That wheel goes to this pulley, goes to that belt, to that pulley, and then it goes through there over to the chain. So actually, when you drive the wheel, when you drive the tire turns, and the tire is what makes this turn. And that way it feeds it in. But it's just really smart that it's just a mechanical connection, so that way it feeds
it in. So this doesn't have an engine?
No. It's powered off of the PTO shaft of the tractor.
Right.
So yeah, so that runs off of, it's just a simple mechanical connection.
Yeah, so you've used this?
Yeah. Yeah, we've harvested our, like, oats and wheat and rye and barley with it. Harvested our black beans.
The cut downer and the processor.
Yeah, the combination harvester thresher, hence the name combine. That's where that came from.
All right, to learn more about the EQIP program, which was mentioned there in that segment, and funding opportunities for rural landowners wanting to make a more environmentally conscious usage change, check out the nrcs.usda.gov, or you can search for EQIP program. Now, Sacred Sun is not yet an organic farm technically by the OCIA standards, though they plan to be in the next year. And one real benefit that we get from knowing about the farmers and their families and the land is that those people are more healthy, and this is what drives me to support this type of growing when I shop for things that I eat. And if you're an avid eater like myself, you might want to check out some places like the Rosedale Farmers Market, which is taking place from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Sundays. And then there's also the Casey Farm School, which has a market on Fridays from 4 to 7 p.m., and that one is at 4223 Gibbs Road in KCK. And there's plenty more great farmers markets. You know, tomorrow there's a Catholic Charities Farmers Market in KCK at 22nd Central, and so many more that you can find out about from kcfoodcircle.org. So check out kcfoodcircle.org and learn about all the great markets and great food that you can get. Thank you so much for tuning in. Stay tuned for Fiesta Musical.
Do you have a podcast? Do you want to learn how to podcast? KKFI is growing, and along with the launch of our new website, KKFI will be a new home for expanded podcast programming and education. If you are interested in learning more, send an email to podcast@kkfi.org.
Bill McKibben on the next Alternative Radio.
Because look, you and I are going to be dead before the absolute worst of this kicks in. But if you're 12 right now, or 14 or 18 or something, it's going to be right at the moment when you should be in the prime of your life. They understand at some gut level the unfairness of it. And boy, it's good to see them calling people out on it.
Planet in Peril, Wednesday, 9 a.m.
It's raining plastics. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Recently, it's been raining and snowing so much in Colorado that for the first time in years, the entire state is drought-free.
Many probably didn't expect so much precipitation, and it's certain people did not expect what may have come down in those raindrops. Plastics.
As explained by Circle of Blue, a USGS scientist who was looking for fragments of metal or coal that might explain how nitrogen was polluting Rocky Mountain National Park, instead found plastics in rain samples.
The USGS study showed that 90% of rain samples from the Denver Boulder area contained tiny plastics that were visible only through magnification. Even samples taken at Rocky Mountain National Park, about 70 miles northwest of Denver and 5,000 feet higher, had the plastics.
How did they get there? Austin Baldwin, one of the co-authors of the study, theorized that the tiny particles could be released into the air from drying synthetic clothes or even laundry water.
It also might come from the degradation of auto and truck tires, but Baldwin told Circle of Blue, right now, there are more questions than answers.
Have you been wondering about dates on food that use terms like use before or sell by? Those labels can be confusing and lead some to toss out perfectly good food that they believe is no longer edible.
The Food and Drug Administration agreed that the labels aren't helpful, and it now favors a single designation, best if used by. That new term doesn't mean food is unsafe to eat, only that the quality isn't as good after that date. If put into practice, the new label could help reduce the huge problem of food waste.
Most discarded food in North America goes into landfills, which contaminate groundwater and emit methane, a powerful greenhouse gas. The average person tosses about 900 pounds of food per year.
But a new technology developed by researchers at Waterloo University in Ontario might be able to turn that food waste into a source of energy by mixing it with a microbial cocktail.
The process uses natural fermentation to make a biodegradable chemical, which has numerous potential uses, such as a substitute for petroleum or crude oil. The scientists hope to commercialize the technique within 4 or 5 years.
After wildfires in California, the U.S. Forest Service partners with private logging companies to clear away burned trees based on the rationale that dead trees become piles of fuel for the next fire.
The agency says that leaving piles of burned bark in the forest can fuel wildfires so hot that trees can no longer grow in the charred soil.
However, nearly 300 scientists from across the country believe that post-fire logging contributes to faster and more devastating wildfires.
Dr. Chad Hansen, a forest and fire ecologist, told NBC that post-fire logging is based on a dangerous falsehood, and he joined the other scientists who wrote to Congress urging them to scale back the practice.
Hansen said that what they're removing just doesn't burn, and instead allowing the dead trees to fall and rot creates a natural fire barrier that soaks up and retains huge amounts of soil moisture, acting like giant sponges instead of fuel. The burned trees are also a favorite place for insects and birds.
The traditional ways of dealing with a body after death have been burial or cremation. But now, a new method based upon how dead livestock are handled has just been approved by the state of Washington.
Human composting is remarkably straightforward, as Business Insider reports. After a person dies, the immune system stops working and decay begins almost immediately as bacteria start to decompose the body.
A process has been developed by a firm called Recompose, which would place a body in a vessel with wood chips, alfalfa, and straw, where it would break down in 3 to 7 weeks.
Compared to cremation, recomposition uses about 1/8 the energy and saves a metric ton of carbon dioxide from being emitted. Caskets used in traditional burials can leach metal and toxins into cemetery soils.
Human composting yields a dry, fluffy soil that families can use in their gardens, just like a bag of topsoil from a nursery. And the charge for body composting is about $5,500, which is a bit more than cremation, but less than burial in a casket.
And finally, Memorial Day weekend officially kicks off summer, and many people gather in parks for barbecues or picnics. While parks offer a respite from concrete and asphalt, for many city planners, they're becoming a powerful tool against the impacts of climate change.
That's according to the nonprofit Trust for Public Land, which says green spaces can help mitigate effects from global warming, such as flooding, intense heat, sea level rise, and poor air quality.
And it's not just about trees offering shade. Green spaces can help sequester carbon and support lifestyles that reduce fossil fuel use by making it easier for people to get around without cars.
Also, new landscape design, known as green infrastructure, allows parks to be inviting spaces and manage stormwater runoff by keeping pollutants out of waterways as weather becomes more extreme.
The good news is parks are growing in number and more people have access. The Trust released its 2019 Park Index last week that evaluates the nation's top 100 cities and their parks.
One of the report's criteria that's becoming increasingly important is the percent of residents who are within a 10-minute walk of a park. In the latest survey, the number of people who have a short walk to a park has increased.
U.S. News reports that the Trust describes a race among cities to see who can be the greenest, as they view parks not only as attractive and a public health asset, but also as a way to adapt to climate change.
If the trend continues, fighting the climate crisis for cities could be a walk in the park.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Explore new trends and technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
Thanks for listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Here's the calendar of events for the week of 5/27/19. Tuesday, May 28, reception starts at 6 p.m., program at 6:30 at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Library. Susan Rademacher, a leader in the Parks Conservancy Movement, examines strategies for keeping Kansas City's signature system of parks and boulevards relevant and sustainable. No cost, open to all. Go to kclibrary.org to RSVP. Wednesday, May 29th at 9 a.m., KKFI will broadcast alternative radio featuring Bill McKibben, a leading environmentalist. Thursday, May 30, 6 to 7 p.m., How to Attract Pollinators and Add Native Plants to Your Garden is a no-cost, open-to-all gardening workshop at the Olathe Community Center, 1205 East Kansas City Road, Olathe, Kansas. To reserve a spot, register at bridgingthegap.org. Friday, 5:31, Hike the Night, 8:30 p.m. at Baker Wetlands, 1365 North 1250 Road, Lawrence, Kansas. Here's your chance to find out what the wetlands are like at night. No cost and open for all ages. To register, email mglade@bakeru.edu or call 785-594-4703. Bring a flashlight. Saturday, June 1st, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., there's a Prairie Block Party. On National Prairie and National Trails Day, there will be a no-cost open-to-the-public party at Burroughs Creek Park, 900 East 15th Street, Lawrence, Kansas. Party includes live music, great eats from a variety of food trucks, hands-on nature and art activities, and trail and creek exploring. Also on June 1st, 9 a.m. to 12 p.m., experience the health and wellness benefits of Shinrin Yoku, the Japanese practice of forest bathing, at a no-cost class. Discover nature, forest therapy, nature, and wellness in a 2.5-hour relaxing walk around the grounds of Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center, 4750 Troost Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. Program will take place rain or shine. Registration is required. Go to Anita Gorman Center online. Oakwood Farm Wildflower Walk with Courtney Masterson is Saturday, June 1st, 10 a.m. to noon. 29, 2391 Northeast 31st Street, Topeka, Kansas. Please wear clothes and shoes for hiking. Please bring your own water. For more information, see the Facebook event. RSVP with Jerry Jost at jjost@klt.org to be personally notified if the walk is canceled in case of inclement weather. Hidden Valley Trails Day will be Saturday, June 1st, 9 a.m. to noon, 3420 Bob Billings Parkway, Lawrence, Kansas. These items and more can be found at the kkfi.org Eco Radio KC program page or on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.